In the light of the emphasis placed on working the rough stone among Russian Freemasons in the latter half of the 18th century, it is extremely intriguing to study the personal seal adopted by Peter the Great from at least as early as January 1714. And this is it here. The central motif of the seal shows a Mason king hewing a feminine, regal figure, replete with an orb and scepter from a rough stone. This image draws on the Pygmalion myth, as narrated by Ovid in the 10th book of Metamorphoses, in which the Cypriot king carved a beautiful ivory statue. Enamoured with his own creation, Pygmalion asked the god to animate his ivory maiden, which they agreed to do. The Masonic symbolism contained in this ancient myth was not lost on the 19th century American Masonic scholar J.D. Buck, who in 1869 wrote that these great truths are like a divine image concealed in a block of stone, the rough ashlar, which many artisans assail with mallet and chisel, perchance to release a distorted idol. Only the perfect master can so chip away the stone as to reveal in all its grandeur and beauty the divine ideal, and endow it with the breath of life. Such is the building of character. The fable of Pygmalion and Galatea is, after all, more real than history. I would argue that the so-called divine ideal being hewn in Peter the Great's seal is Russia, with the monarch portraying himself as a Mason king capable of transforming the country from its previous crude and base condition. Indeed, the sermon delivered by Feofan Prokopovich at Peter the Great's funeral in 1725 exalted the monarch as a skilled Mason sculptor. And I quote, "All of Russia is your statue. From you it is recast, and in your emblem it is not falsely portrayed." Other motifs clearly visible in the seal also add to its Masonic character. The two columns, clearly visible there, standing to the right of the Mason King, for example, strike one as being evocative of the pillars of Yakin and Boaz that stood at the entrance to the Temple of Solomon. According to the Bible, Hiram of Tyre cast these pillars, and it is said that Israelite rulers of the house of David were subsequently crowned at their base. These Solomonic pillars play a pivotal role in Masonic tradition. Moreover, I would argue that their presence in Peter the Great's seal suggests that the Russian monarch consciously perceived himself as a worthy heir to the house of David in his attempt to establish a new Jerusalem in Russia. It's important to bear in mind that Peter the Great's embrace of Masonic style symbolism arose at a time when St. Petersburg had become the new Russian capital and was emerging as one of the great European cities. Thus, not only was the city awash with stonemasons applying their craft, but its rise from the boggy landscape on the banks of the River Neva also fueled Peter's perception of himself as a divinely ordained monarch. Further Masonic style imagery can be seen in the upper section of the seal, where one can see a radiant all-seeing eye that also contains the Tetragrammaton, the Hebrew name of God. Significantly, it has been noted that this striking combination was first utilised in Russia in the prints for Peter the Great's seal. In other words, Peter the Great was not simply drawing on a pre-existing Baroque tradition present in Russia, but was consciously forging a new visual symbolic language. The divinely sanctioned nature of Peter the Great's Masonic mission is stressed by the Latin word adjuvante, which you can see here, that adorns the uppermost section of the seal. In combination with the Tetragrammaton, this word signifies that the task of working the rough stone will be carried out with God's help. A somewhat inverted version of the image, this one here, on Peter the Great's seal, was also frequently used after the victorious conclusion of the Great Northern War in 1721, when the monarch assumed the title of Emperor and Father of the Fatherland. In a circular relief produced to commemorate the Russian victory, for example, one can see a Mason hewing a male monarch from rough stone. Central image here. In addition, it is once again possible to note a distinctive arch, a radiant all-seeing eye, and the Latin word adjuvante, as well as a ship. Crucially, one can also view a depiction of the Angel of Victory, reaching up to crown the monarch as emperor, symbolising that Peter the Great had finally been carved into his perfected form as the ruler of Russia. Moreover, it is also extremely significant that the Tetragrammaton has been replaced within the radiant sun by three sevens. One, two, three. In official celebrations held to mark the Neustadt Peace Treaty, much was made of the fact that the Great Northern War lasted for 21 years and was divided into three significant periods. On New Year's Day 1722, for example, Theophilakh Lopatinsky stressed in an official speech that God favoured odd numbers when orchestrating earthly affairs. 4 weeks later, Prokopovich made reference to the prophetic calculations of Ezekiel, Daniel and John in regard to the length and division of the war, and contemplated the significance of the number of the Trinity. Given the subject matter of the central motif in the circular relief, it is worth noting that numbers 3 and 7 hold special significance in Masonic symbolism. In Albert McKay's Encyclopedia of Freemasonry, for example, the author describes that in Freemasonry, the tenary is the most sacred of all the mystical numbers, and he cites the three degrees of the craft, as well as the fact that there are three principal officers in a lodge, as examples. McKay also notes that 7 is a sacred number in Masonic symbolism, and that in the earliest instructions of the 18th century, it was said that a lodge required 7 to make it perfect. In addition, the author refers to the mystical significance of the number 7 in relation to the 7 liberal arts, the 7 steps of the winding stairs, the 7 days of the week, the ancient belief in the 7 planets, and the 7 notes of the musical scale. Thus, I would argue that Peter the Great's personal seal, as well as the various prints, reliefs, and busts that subsequently adopted a similar theme, provide visual evidence of an outlook seemingly in accord with Masonic symbolism. Indeed, Peter the Great's utilisation of Masonic style symbolism in the 1710s and 1720s occurred precisely at a time when Freemasonry began to flourish in Britain and set down foundations in continental Europe. Hence, it begs the question of whether Peter the Great was consciously aware of the Masonic symbolism inherent in his personal seal. Since the 19th century, a host of Russian and Western scholars have addressed the question of whether Peter the Great himself was actually a Freemason. You have overlooked the powerful visual symbolism present in many prints and designs commissioned by the Russian monarch. What is more, little attention has been paid to the similarities between the common reformative goals of Freemasonry and Peter the Great's efforts to bring about cultural, religious, philosophical, social, and political transformation in Russia. Instead, scholars have been drawn to two particular legends, attesting that Peter the Great was initiated into the craft during his travels to Western Europe. According to one legend, Christopher Wren initiated Peter the Great into Freemasonry in 1698, that is, during the Russian monarch's three-month residence in London. The other principal legend recounts how Peter the Great brought back a Masonic statue to found a lodge on the island of Kronstadt in the Gulf of Finland after his second Grand Embassy in 1717. In support of these legends, it is customary to point to the fact that Russian Freemasons in the last quarter of the 18th century were known to sing Dershavin's song to Peter the Great and to revere his name in lodges. Whilst these legends are undoubtedly seductive, I would argue that they have actually deflected attention from more persuasive evidence suggesting Masonic influence at the Petrine court. Indeed, in 1998, Lindsay Hughes, the outstanding scholar of Petrine Russia, wrote that a study of Freemasonry and fraternalism in the reign of Peter the Great requires further investigation, as evidently there existed a number of overlapping groupings and activities which she argued may have influenced the Russian monarch. In support of this sentiment, it is worth considering how Peter the Great's attempts to radically recast his subjects, to borrow Prokopovich's apt phrase, along Western European lines was in harmony with the broad goals of 18th century Freemasonry. In simple terms, these goals stress civic responsibility, politeness, virtue, loyalty to the crown, Christian values, and education. Peter the Great's radical programme of reforms embraced precisely such goals, including the establishment and active promotion of new associative public forms. Douglas Smith has stressed the crucial role played by Freemasonry in Russia in the second half of the 18th century in terms of developing a public sphere parallel to the rise of an absolutist state. Drawing on the pioneering work of Jürgen Habermas and on the research of Margaret Jacob, Smith has powerfully demonstrated the role of new associative forms such as salons, coffee houses, learned societies, fraternal clubs, etc., alongside the growth of a print culture in forging Russia's public sphere and civil society. Whilst new associative forms, including Freemasonry, did flourish in Russia in the second half of the 18th century, their enthusiastic progenitor was Peter the Great. The absolute monarch was the driving force, for example, behind the creation of Russia's first newspaper, Vedomosti, in December 1702, as well as the dramatic expansion in the output of the country's printing presses. During his reign, he also commissioned the publication of an etiquette manual, The Honourable Mirror of Youth, in 1717. This manual prescribed a list of 62 rules that young children should follow, including how to behave at weddings and dances. The Tsar also sought to actively encourage his servitors to adopt new forms of social interaction. Most notably, he issued an Act of Assemblies in November 1718, which outlined the establishment of French-style salon assemblies. The decree stipulated that any decently dressed person was free to attend an assembly at the residence of a private individual, where they were positively encouraged to dance, smoke, play cards and chess, and listen to instrumental music, all forms of entertainment previously viewed by conservatives as devilish. Alongside attending these new assemblies, the public were also encouraged to visit the St. Petersburg Kunstkammer, Russia's first museum. Indeed, at the official opening in 1719, visitors in decent attire were permitted to enter without cost and were tempted by offers of complimentary coffee, wine and vodka. These public initiatives went hand in hand with sweeping educational reforms, which included the foundation of various pedagogical institutions and the Academy of Sciences in 1724. Furthermore, Peter the Great promoted the ideal of meritocratic service to the state when he introduced the Table of Ranks in 1722, which consisted in 14 hierarchical grades for both military and civil positions. As Mark Rayev has stated, masonry offered a parallel or equivalent to the Table of Ranks in public service. Furthermore, in addition to these general features, which I would argue were in broad harmony with the ideals of Freemasonry, I will now examine a number of factors that I believe reinforce the case that Peter the Great would have been well aware of the Masonic symbolism inherent in his personal seal. Firstly, I will outline Peter the Great's enthusiastic sponsorship of various fraternal societies and assemblies in Russia from the early 1690s until his death in 1725. Crucially, these secretive and or exclusive bodies were open to, indeed thrived because of, participants from Western Europe, particularly from Britain. Secondly, I would argue that direct Masonic influence was brought to the Petrine Court by way of a Jacobite network centred around the pivotal figure of Dr. Robert Erskine, Peter the Great's chief physician, as well as being a privy councillor and the first director of the St. Petersburg Kunstkammer. Evidence suggests that key members of this Jacobite network in Russia were Masons, who were not only able to operate in St. Petersburg, but were also able to draw in a senior servitor and relative of Peter the Great into their brotherhood. So on to fraternalism. In the early 1690s, Peter the Great instigated the establishment of the so-called All Mad, All Jesting, All Drunken Assembly. This notorious institution constituted a mock church hierarchy and a mock court led by an appointed Prince Pope and Prince Caesar, respectively. Both bodies functioned according to a strict hierarchical structure, with appointed metropolitans, sacristans, deacons, subdeacons, a dean, secretaries, and so on. Peter the Great assumed the relatively lowly rank of proto-deacon in this assembly. The assembly also enlisted various entertainers, including 12 thundering stammerers, bird-like singers, Russian minstrels, jesters, and fools. One such fool, or dudak, was a mad Frenchman that Peter the Great had acquired from the King of Poland, who was known as Wimienka, or officially as Cardinal and Prince Wimieni, King of the Samoyeds. Females were also permitted to take part in the mock assembly, the most prominent of whom was Daria Rushevskaya, who in 1712 was granted the title of Princess Abbess. In 1717, she was promoted to the rank of Arch-Abbess and was lauded by the new Prince Pope, Peter Buterlin, for her drinking exploits before the assembly. Besides the Arch-Abbess, the assembly also contained Mother Superiors, Deaconesses, Nuns, and Servants of Bacchus. In addition to a strict mock hierarchy, the assembly also displayed a number of other distinctive features. It embraced crude and blasphemous language, for example, which still retains the power to shock those of a more sensitive disposition. All members of the assembly were given nicknames, which more often than not contain the Russian word khui, which translates as penis. Thus, Peter the Great's nickname was Pakom Pakakui, which I think is nonsense. Whilst another assembly member, Archdeacon Stroyev, was known as Idinakui, which isn't nonsense, and it's a phrase still used in Russia today to crudely inform someone to go away. The assembly was also awash with bacchanalian symbolism. Drunkenness and dissipation were championed in the guises of Ivashka, Khmelnytsky, and Ilemka, respectively. Moreover, the Roman god Bacchus played a central role in the rituals and ceremonies of the assembly. For example, at the so-called conclave to elect a new prince pope on December the 28th, 1717, I've just got an image there of a public festivity of the assembly. The assembled members began by striking up a song to Bacchus, before then beseeching the god to help them in the task ahead. Further exclamations pronounced the attendees to be the utmost devotees and first sons of our father Bacchus. In general, despite the abundance of parody and mockery unleashed in the assembly, It was a hierarchical body marked by defined rituals, ceremonies, and regulations that sought to direct the behaviour of members. Interestingly, the assembly also functioned in both the private and public spheres. All meetings of the assembly, for example, were concealed from the gaze of the public. However, on festive occasions such as weddings, such as this print illustrates here, Christmas and Shrovetide, the members of the assembly took to the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg in grand carnivalesque processions that openly mocked the church and old Muscovite traditions. What factors contributed to the birth of the All-Mad Assembly in the 1690s? It seems probable that Peter the Great's rise to power in 1689 was of critical importance, along with witnessing the election of the Patriarch Adrian in 1690. However, it is also likely that the young Tsar's frequent visits to the foreign quarter in Moscow, particularly to the residences of Patrick Gordon, a Scottish Jacobite, and Franz Lefort, a Swiss Reformed, actually he was a Calvinist, introduced him to new forms of fraternal bonding and drunken revelry. This is easy to imagine if one bears in mind the fact that locals referred to the area in the late 17th century as the Drunken Quarter. It is impossible to ascertain the precise degree of foreign influence on the foundation of the mock assembly in the early 1690s. However, it is fascinating to note that a parallel fraternal organisation, run by foreign residents in Russia, predominantly from Britain, was in existence from at least as early as the first decade of the 18th century. In January 1706, Charles Whitworth, the British representative in Moscow, wrote of the activities of a brotherhood as true as pleasant, where a great glass of wine sanctified the occasion. In all likelihood, this brotherhood referred to the so-called Bung College, or British Monastery. It is not precisely known when the Bung College was established, but the first firm evidence of its existence dates from August 10, 1709. It was on this date that a warrant was issued in Kiev, which informed the British Metropolitan in Moscow that a certain William Lloyd had been promoted from the rank of deacon to archdeacon. The warrant was signed by Proto-Deacon Peter and Archdeacon Gideon Shakovsky. In other words, Lloyd's promotion had been authorised by Peter the Great himself, along with Prince Shakovsky, a fellow member of the mock assembly. This indicates that the Bung College was subordinate to the All-Mad Assembly, but highlights the close links between the two fraternal organisations. These tight bonds are reinforced by the fact that in a letter from March 6, 1708, Peter the Great lists British metropolitans, that is, members of the highest orders of the Russian Orthodox Church, among the members of the All-Mad Assembly. The similarities between the Bung College and the All-Mad Assembly become apparent if one consults an announcement and register of the former body, which was written on April 20, 1720. In this document, it is stated that the All-Mad Brotherhood of the British Monastery meets on Dvaryanskaya Street, opposite the home of Peter Buterlin, the Prince Pope, and Prince Bacchus. The announcement proceeds to state that in this monastery, the Brotherhood of the All-Mad Assembly reside in common according to the law of Bacchus. In total, 55 members are listed as belonging to the All-Mad Brotherhood, a figure which includes four female cooks. 15 religious positions are given, as well as 15 other posts, including an orator, a solicitor general, and a keeper of the seraglio. Other specified roles include a bagpiper, and controversially, a cuntpiper. Of the 46 named brothers of the college, 28 were British, among whom are listed Sir Henry Stirling, named as Professor and Doctor of Civil Law, and Henry Farson, named as the Professor of Mathematics. Both these men were Scottish Jacobites, a theme I'll return to in a bit. The regulations of the college stipulate that members of the All-Mad Brotherhood are to wear a green leek in their hats. Moreover, in order to honour the Prince Pope, they made a flag, on which was drawn a green onion and an image of St. David. Rather Welsh in flavour, I think. The regulations also outline a series of four punishments for brothers who violate the Lord of Bacchus. Number one, the president of the Brotherhood is to strike his hand on the bare buttocks of the guilty party. Number two, the guilty brother is to be tossed in a blanket. Number three, cold water is to be poured down the sleeves of the guilty party so that it emerges from the trousers. And number four, and this one's the worst one, two hungry ducks are to be set upon an offender whose penis has been smeared with egg yolk and oats. Rather than me, for that one. The existence of the All-Mad Assembly and the Bung College were contemporaneous with similar blasphemous and mock fraternities in Western Europe. In France, for example, the Order of the Grape was founded in Arles in 1693, and by 1703 had established lodges in Paris, Cologne, Bern, Milan, and as far afield as Constantinople. This Bacchanalian order had a Grand Master, officers, and a Council of Order, along with certificates and seals for its new initiates. Furthermore, a select group of young aristocrats formed a secret society called the Regiment of the Culotte in 1702. The culotte was a small grey cap worn by members, which they adorned with little bells, butterflies, rats, and weather vanes. The society chose Momus, the Greek god of ridicule and mockery, as their patron. As with the All-Mad Assembly, the French society met in secret in order to carry out their rituals and ceremonies and performed acts of ridicule in the public sphere. Significantly, both the All-Mad Assembly and the Bung College also bear many similar features to the Knights of Jubilation, which was active in The Hague from at least as early as 1710. Margaret Jacob has written extensively on this secret society, which she argues had a decidedly Masonic character, highlighting the combination of its playful, bawdy exuberance alongside a ritualised and hierarchical brotherhood governed by a series of regulations. Furthermore, a fascinating insight into the proliferation of secret clubs in England at this time can be gleaned from Ned Ward's The Secret History of Clubs, published in London in 1709. This wonderful satirical work mixes documented clubs, such as the Yorkshire Club of Northern Tykes, the Molly's Club and the Kit Kat Club, with seemingly fictitious societies, the most notable of which include the Farting Club and the No-Nose Club. However, despite this blurring of fact and probable fiction, the secret history of clubs throws valuable light on the extent to which secret clubs have become designated spaces for the expression of bawdy and blasphemous sentiments. In this regard, it is fitting to quote the scathing words of Ward himself in his opening remarks on clubs in general, which he states have flourished in England since the middle of the 17th century. And I'll just read this out as well. For notwithstanding their formal orders, exemplified at large by some scrivener's apprentice and ostentatiously hung up in lacquered frames as the laws of the society, the ridiculous chaplets that crown the empty noodles of their officious stewards and adorn their temples like fiddlers in a music booth, their honorary white wands, which like a churchwarden's pew they wear as badges of their fanatical authority, contemptible ceremonies which heretofore have been frequently supported in all such sort of bacchanalian communities, presuming thereby to govern one another with such a solemn decorum as might preserve peace, unity, and sobriety, and punish all immorality and profaneness by pecuniary amercements, that they might have more to be drunk with at their next quarterly festival. The principal felicities that ever were enjoyed by the giddy members and promoters of such suck-bottle assemblies have been inebrious health drink and impertinent tittle-tattle. I don't think you like the clubs. The first club described by Ward in his history, the Virtuosos Club, purportedly met to propagate new whims, advanced mechanical exercises, and to promote useless as well as useful experiments. Moreover, a brother of this teeming society was respected according to the searches he had made into the mysteries of nature and by their vain pursuit of the Philosopher's Stone. This withering attack on a club, allegedly linked to the Royal Society in London, echoes the rumours and suspicion associated with the Neptune Society in Peter the Great's Russia. Little is known about the activities of this society, which initially met at the Sukharia Tower in Moscow. And here's a picture of it here before it was demolished in 1934 by Stalin. This was home to Russia's first mathematical and navigation school and the country's first observatory. According to various 19th century accounts, members of the society engaged in experimental science, with Peter the Great as its overseer and the leading cleric, Prokopovich, as its orator. Other members included Henry Farson and Jacob Bruce, who both shared Jacobite loyalties, as well as various other prominent Russian officials. Alongside these fraternal societies, Peter the Great also established the Chivalric Order of the Holy Apostle Andrew the First Named on his return from his Grand Embassy in the autumn of 1698. Interestingly, Knights of the Order, which ranked as the most prestigious honour in Petrine Russia, were also central in the All-Mad Assembly. The first Knight of the Order, Fyodor Golovin, for example, was also the drunken proto-presbyter in the mock council. Jacob Bruce, of Scottish descent, was also a Knight of the Order whilst participating in the All-Mad Assembly and allegedly being a member of the Neptune Society. In other words, inclusion in the Brotherhood of the All-Mad Assembly and the Neptune Society was a definite sign of the monarch's trust and favour. Peter the Great's enthusiastic patronage of the All-Mad Assembly, the Bung College, and the Neptune Society does not provide direct evidence of Masonic influence at the Petrine Court. However, they do demonstrate a court culture orchestrated by the monarch that was permeated with a spirit strongly reminiscent of Freemasonry in the early 18th century. It is important to remember that the bacchanalian antics of the All-Mad Assembly and the Bung College, even when carried out in the public sphere, were not simply forms of carnivalesque anti-behaviour borrowed from popular culture. True, the inherent possibilities granted by the collapse of conventional boundaries at traditional periods of festive carnival did enable the societies to display their bacchanalian spirit on the streets. However, one should remember that these riotous antics did not cease at the end of the festive period. Rather, they returned to the private sphere, where initiates continued to act in the same manner among their select peers. Moreover, the All Mad Assembly and the Bung College adopted a highly codified and hierarchical form of behaviour among themselves that went against the chaotic spirit of liminality associated with popular carnival periods. The intrinsic importance of order in the Brotherhoods of the All Mad Assembly and the Bung College is demonstrated by the strict regulations set out by the societies, reinforced by a series of prescribed punishments and fines for offenders. Thus, these societies were an entirely innovative phenomenon in Russia, and I would argue thrived on the dynamic interaction between Russian courtiers and Western, particularly British, residents. The significance of this complex interaction should not be underplayed, as it reveals that Russian court culture was at the forefront of the development of fraternal societies in Europe. In other words, it did not lag behind Western Europe in any sense, a fact highlighted by noting that both the All Mad Assembly and the Bung College significantly predate the infamous Hellfire Club in England, which was established, I think, in about 1719 and 1720 by the Duke of Wharton. What is more, judging by the description of Masonic lodges in Russia in the 1750s, given by Ivan Yelagin, who was one of the most preeminent Russian Masons in the second half of the 18th century, it appears that there was little to distinguish them from the earlier fraternal societies of the Petrine era. He wrote, for example, that lodge meetings were simply, and I quote, an amusement for people who want to entertain themselves, sometimes inexcusably and indecently, and for brothers who wanted to indulge in shouting unintelligible and disharmonious songs at the ceremonial banquet, to become intoxicated on good wine, and to end this dedication to Minerva with worship to Bacchus. Such behaviour was entirely in the spirit of the bacchanalian atmosphere of the societies promoted by Peter the Great, and on this count alone, it would seem entirely appropriate that some Russian Masons chose to raise a glass to the Tsar and to revere his name in song. Moving on now to Robert Erskine and the Jacobite connection. The most compelling evidence of direct Masonic influence at the Petrine court centres on a Jacobite network based around the influential figure of Dr. Robert Erskine. Erskine arrived in Russia in 1704, having undertaken medical studies in Edinburgh, Paris and Utrecht, and after being made a Fellow of the Royal Society in 1703. By the time of his death in 1718, coincidentally on St. Andrew's Day, 30th of November, the Scot had arguably become one of the most powerful of Peter the Great's trusted advisers. He was the Tsar's chief physician, was head of the entire medical chancellery, had been appointed the first director of the St. Petersburg Kunstkammer, as I mentioned before, and its library, and in 1716 had been made a privy councillor. In short, he held enormous sway over the Russian monarch, a fact not overlooked by his Jacobite kinsmen. Erskine emanated from one of the most influential families in Scotland, and was the first cousin of the Jacobite leader, John Erskine, the Earl of Mar. From surviving documents, it appears that Robert Erskine did not engage in any Jacobite activities in Russia between 1704 and 1714. However, events conspired in 1714 to bring Erskine into the Jacobite fold. Firstly, in May 1714, George Mackenzie was appointed British resident in St. Petersburg, having previously been secretary in charge of affairs in Poland between 1710 and 1714. In all likelihood, Mackenzie's new position was dictated by political manoeuvrings by the Earl of Mar, who at the time was British Secretary of State and a member of the Privy Council. From subsequent correspondence, it is clear that Mackenzie was a loyal agent acting on behalf of the Earl of Mar. The death of Queen Anne on the 1st of August 1714 and the subsequent coronation of George I on October the 20th shattered the Earl of Mar's power base. Not only did he lose his position as Secretary of State, but also Mackenzie's new post in St. Petersburg was also immediately thrown into question. This helps us to understand the context of a letter sent by Mackenzie to Mar from St. Petersburg on 29th of October 1714, only 9 days after the coronation of George I. Mackenzie emphasises his precarious position by stating that, "I stand, however, as yet unconfirmed and lean so far on court style as the event may support me." It is fortunate for historians that in Mackenzie's haste to dispatch the letter, he foregoes the procedure of encrypting the document. Consequently, we are able to study an astonishing document that suggests a Masonic network of Scottish Jacobites was able to exert influence at the Russian court via the lofty position of Robert Erskine and, crucially, by drawing on the diplomatic services of a fellow Russian brother. The implications of this document are considerable, especially if one considers the fact that Freemasonry is generally considered to have only entered Russia in 1731, with the first Russian Freemason only being initiated in Paris in 1737. On the fifth and sixth lines of the letter, roughly this part here, Mackenzie clearly explains that Robert Erskine has written a letter of recommendation to his cousin, the Earl of Mar, on behalf of a Mr. Naroshkin, a chamberlain and relation of the Tsar. The individual mentioned by Mackenzie is Semyon Grigorovich Naroshkin, whose father was a first cousin once removed of Natalia Naroshkina, Peter the Great's mother. The letter correctly states that Naroshkin was a chamberlain of the Tsar. Moreover, he was one of the 35 so-called volunteers who accompanied Peter Great on his grand embassy to Western Europe in 1697. Indeed, Naroshkin was a member of a smaller group of volunteers whose foreman was Peter Mikhailov, alias Peter the Great. The Russian monarch left England in April 1698, but Naroshkin stayed on in order to further his education. In 1699, the young student continued his education in Berlin, from where he wrote to the Tsar, keeping him updated on his progress. On completing his studies, Naroshkin became a general adjutant to the Tsar, and in 1708 was awarded the prestigious rank of captain in the lifeguards of the Preobrazhensky Regiment. Significantly, Peter the Great also began entrusting sensitive diplomatic missions to Naroshkin. The Tsar's envoy, for example, spent much of 1711 in Italy and Germany, meeting Cosimo de' Medici III in Florence, and then being charged with enlisting craftsmen into Russian service. Furthermore, in 1712, Naroshkin travelled to Copenhagen on behalf of the Tsar, where he met with King Frederick IV. And the following year, he was sent to Vienna in order to conclude a treaty uniting Russia and the Habsburg Empire against the Ottoman Turks. On the accession of George I to the British throne, Naroshkin was charged with travelling to England in order to congratulate the Hanoverian monarch on behalf of Peter the Great. Yet Mackenzie's letter also reveals two additional subtexts to Naroshkin's official mission. Firstly, he was being employed as a Jacobite courier, who was to be destined the bearer of an answer to a letter our monarch, that is James Francis Stuart, the old pretender, or James III, as Jacobites would call him, that he wrote to this prince from Hanover, or in other words, King George I. Secondly, a distinct Masonic subtext is revealed in Mackenzie's letter, which suggests that not only is he a Mason, but that both the Earl of Mar and Naroshkin, who is referred to as a brother mechanic of his Tsarian Majesty, are also members of the Brotherhood. The reference to not breaking through the Mason word, let me see here, incorporates Mackenzie into a Scottish Masonic tradition dating back to at least the first half of the 17th century. As David Stevenson has noted, the Mason word lay at the centre of esoteric activities described in the Masonic Catechism. The first printed reference to the term dates from 1638, when Henry Adamson of Perth wrote a poem entitled The Muse's Threnody, which states, "For we, the brethren of the Rosy Cross, we have the Mason word and the second sight. Things for to come we can foretell aright." The ritualistic importance of the Mason's word in Scottish Masonry is testified by the so-called Edinburgh Register House manuscript of 1696. This manuscript explains, I quote, "the form of giving the Mason word, as well as elaborating upon," and I quote again, "the grand secret of giving the Mason word, and providing some questions that Masons use to put those who profess to have the Mason word." Further evidence linking the Earl of Mar to Scottish Masonry relates to Mackenzie describing how his lordship, I'll just go back, how his lordship long ago passed the essay master, the last highlighted part here at the bottom. According to David Stevenson, an essay consisted in an exercise in designing a house to a given basic specification and constructing a scale model of it. Thus, it effectively connected the Mason with architecture and was only something to, and I quote, "to be undertaken rather later in the Mason's career, and was set for a privileged minority who went on to become Mason Burgesses and, on approval of an essay, masters of the incorporation." Hence, it would seem, from Mackenzie's letter, that the Earl of Mar was a high-ranking Mason. As far as am I aware, no documentary evidence exists that directly links Robert Erskine with Masonry. However, Mackenzie's letter of October the 14th seems to reveal that Erskine was a pivotal member of a Scottish Jacobite network that included Masons and that attracted a Russian courtier into the craft. What is more, in the aftermath of the unsuccessful Jacobite Rebellion of 1715, led by the Earl of Mar, Robert Erskine facilitated the enlistment into Russian service of a coterie of Jacobite exiles who were, or went on to become, either Freemasons or members of Masonic-style fraternities. In enlisting Jacobite exiles, Erskine took full advantage of being in the Low Countries and in France during 1716 and 1717, where he was accompanying the Tsar on his second tour of Western Europe. The new Jacobite recruits into Russian service at this time included Sir Henry Stirling, who was Erskine's nephew. As mentioned earlier, Stirling was a member of the Bung College. Moreover, Stirling went on to become one of the select members of the most ancient, the most illustrious, and the most noble order del Toboso, after it was founded in 1731. The order has a designated Grand Master, contained only 12 known members, all of whom were Jacobites, and four of whom were also known to have been Freemasons. The order seems to have been geographically split between Rome, which had 7 members, and Russia, which had 5 members. Significantly, Erskine had enlisted 5 of the 12 members into Russian service: Sir Henry Stirling, Captain William Hay, Admiral Thomas Gordon, Rear Admiral Thomas Saunders, and Captain Robert Little. In February 1732, Hay sent 2 rings of the Order of Toboso to Stirling and Gordon from Rome, and informed his friends that, quote, after drinking the healths of the royal family, that'll be the Jacobite royal family, they have a fair meeting on the Green Fellows. To conclude, it was through Robert Erskine's close relationship with Peter the Great that a Jacobite network was able to prosper in Russia after 1714. The esteem in which Erskine was held by the Tsar is highlighted by the Scots funeral, held in St. Petersburg on January 4, 1719, which was accorded full state honours. According to an eyewitness account of the funeral, Peter gave some marks of the esteem he had for the deceased, and at the same time showed particular favour towards his relation, Sir Harry Stirling. The monarch also followed the corpse, carrying a burning taper as far as the funeral vault. Thus, given Erskine's links with the Masonic circle of the Earl of Mar, Mackenzie and Narishkin, it is entirely plausible that this grouping had some influence in court circles. Indeed, Narishkin was a prominent courtier up until 1718, when he was implicated in the affair of the Tsarevich Alexei, who was accused of various charges, including treachery. The journal of Peter the Great's favourite, Alexander Menshikov, contains many references, for example, to General Adjutant Gaspardine Narishkin dining with him in 1716. This influence would arguably have not been possible with at least the tacit support of Peter the Great. Indeed, one can ask, what would Peter the Great have objected to if he had become aware of a Masonic power base at court? After all, his personal seal is awash with Masonic-style symbolism. Here is a Mason king hewing his country into perfected form. On hearing of Peter's death, the English playwright and theatre manager Aaron Hill wrote that the monarch new-moulded his countrymen. This is a fitting eulogy for a monarch craftsman, who in establishing new forms of public association, behaviour and etiquette, alongside wholesale government reform, sought to embody the Masonic ideal of smoothing the rough stone. His reign, Masonic notions of chivalry were also completely in keeping with Peter the Great's promotion of the Knightly Order of the Holy Apostle Andrew. What is more, the practical foundations of Masonry, combined with its mythological and biblical ontology, matched Peter the Great's own worldview. The Russian monarch is rightly famed for his practicality, yet he was also acutely aware what he perceived as, or certainly wanted others to perceive as, his divine mission as a king, continuing the work of the House of David. This duality bears a striking resemblance to Freemasonry as it developed at the start of the 18th century. In concluding, I would argue that further studies on the influence of Freemasonry in Petrine Russia, as advocated by Lindsay Hughes, would not only help to broaden our understanding of Russia in this age, but would also help to increase our knowledge of the early pan-European nature of the fraternal brotherhood. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert, for your most inspiring lecture. And I would like to open the discussion and time for questions. So please, any questions and reactions from the audience first?
Is there any indication of popular reaction to the All Mad Assembly and how that goes on? And it seems a bit. You wonder what.
It's strange. I'm not sure. There's a lot of reaction from foreign visitors commenting
travel diaries and memoirs. Some even took part themselves. Slightly aghast, but also you feel they might have rather enjoyed it as well.
Yeah.
Robert Erskine took part in the ceremony, wedding ceremony there, dressed up. Everyone had to be dressed up in certain outfits. I think you could see some Chinese outfits there. So I'm not sure what the popular reaction was. There aren't many documents that would say what the, I mean, in some ways it paralleled popular celebrations, popular carnival celebrations, Maslen Mitzvah or Shrovetide, where rules were turned upside down. So in that way it did embrace popular culture. But I feel it's like slightly, this was a public procession in some ways, whereas it also continued in private, which certainly didn't happen, and outside the 3-day carnival, or however long it lasted.
I was just saying, you couldn't really imagine his predecessor and his people that came after him carrying on in the same fashion. People got a lot more.
It did, although, I mean, years ago, when I studied my MA, I looked at sort of carnivalesque behaviour of the Russian rulers, and Anna, for example, in the 1740s, used quite a lot of carnivalesque behaviour. There's one incident of her marrying a couple of dwarfs and creating a sort of igloo on the Dnieper in St. Petersburg with holes in it so that all the courtiers would look whilst they had to consummate their marriage, which is, I think, a Russian tradition. Not looking, but obviously building some kind of hut or home, but this was a sort of carnivalesque expression. And this was 1740, so it did carry on until maybe Catherine,
right.
I would say.
So is it a continuation of the medieval Day of Fools, Twelfth Night, and all those traditions?
To an extent, it is, yeah. With what I would say was a sort of a twist in that it carried on as well in the private sphere, which was, and also it was used as a progressive tool to attack his enemies, whether they be in church officials or traditional boyars, the old nobles.
But I mean, it was the same in medieval times, which is why it wasn't popular.
Yeah. I'm not sure, as far as I'm aware, that any previous Russian czar went to such lengths and such detail in these sort of carnivalesque. Well, Ivan the Terrible certainly probably did, actually. That's one other example. But Peter the Great certainly put a lot of work into these ceremonies.
Peter the Great was also, in many respects, a cruel ruler.
Mm.
I mean, being a Swede, of course, and to stay
exactly.
But might it be that this form of organized sociability, any kind of function of compensation for the ruling elites? So I mean, if you create if you're very tolerant towards this kind of fraternal sociability, a lot of drinking culture, carnivalesque, or even moral ideals in a sense, yes. Is that a way to make the intelligent elite to pacify the intelligent elite, basically?
Yeah. It seems to sort of a classic sort of example of a mixture of popular Russian tradition with a sort of innovation possibly coming in from the foreign residents, the English and the Scots, with these clubs with Bacchanalian spirit, which Peter the Great managed to blend into this assembly, which is both public and private, which mixed traditional elements of Russian culture with this new form of association, the club, the associated club, the Bacchanalian style club, which was secret in the sense that it wasn't open, it was an exclusive club, open to only select members. So in that way it mixed tradition and new forms of Western social association, I think.
Are you suggesting then that there's an element of Peter as a a consummate politician organising a group that gives a public image of here is a close, almost a court around his area, a social side of the court to which the next tier down could possibly aspire to, and then as a sort of to grow a group of loyal people around him who he can know and trust and work with around his own political area, but then there's an aspiration to the next tier down to grow and develop into that.
Absolutely, I think there's a real interrelation between the chivalric orders, for example. Many of them, there are only, in his reign, roughly about 20 people were knighted, and I'd say the vast majority of those were also members of the mock assembly. So that in one sense there was a sort of the face of honour, and in another sense it was also an honour to be in the mock assembly. And that the two went hand in hand in some ways together. You can't separate them in some senses. So it did, I think, reinforce a certain hierarchy and a certain order. And if you were a member of this mock assembly, you were one of the privileged. Although there were members in the mock assembly as well that were ridiculed, as they were conservative, but they knew that in a sense. They were against the reforms, but they were there to be ridiculed, as were some of the members of the mock assembly who were simply there because of their appearance, like dwarves or the king of the Samoyeds, who was just a French fool. They were there just to entertain. But there would have been a clear difference in the hierarchy. Yeah. Indeed, the mock assembly itself was hierarchical, of course, with the metropolitan at the top, the patriarch at the top, so followed by metropolitan, and going down. There's a clear hierarchy there. And Peter the Great typically didn't take the top position. He was a proto-deacon in the mock assembly. So he always liked to work his way up in military honours or in any kind of honour. He would start at the bottom and work his way up.
I'm listening to this as someone who doesn't know anything about any that's been brought along to it. I don't know.
Okay.
But it just strikes me, it sounds quite like team building exercises that you go on with your office and stuff.
Yeah.
It does look a bit, you know, where you have to cross a lake with a raft made out of oil drums or something. It sounds like he was doing similar thing, really.
You have the sort of official employee of the month.
Yeah.
And then you can go on a works night out.
It also sort of gives you a little bit of way with your co-workers, because you've seen them doing something ridiculous, you can then leverage that against them later on, I think.
It's bonding,
I think it sounds to me, as I said, I don't know anything about it, it does sound a little bit like that to me.
I mean, of course, it's still, you know, men as well, with their sort of liking, you know, all with every single member of the mock assembly nearly of significance had this koi at the end, this penis, so you would be something penis, and it was just like, you know, a joke, but it was something that they stuck to as well. They had their official title, the patriarch, but then their joke title as well.
I think that's a very good point, because if you look at the function of Freemasonry in other European countries later throughout the century, or other fraternal organizations, there are some cases where these organizations were used to forge a new elite, in a sense, and exactly to create these bonds between people. So I think that's a very good point, actually.
You're sort of vetting people to see whether they really do want to be in your social circle.
Exactly.
Enough to be married to a dwarf or something.
Yes.
What you're saying there, it sounds like there must have been, it's like he's trying to forge a kind of counterpart to the boyars, who, you know, as I understand it, with a traditional kind of ruling elite, almost like a kind of upper middle class or an upper class aristocracy. But they must have been, I don't know if they were still around at this time, but if they were, they were the remnants. That traditional gang, they must have been out of
the Trubetskoys and other families were old boyar family, so they maintained a lot of power and influence. But Peter the Great knew that they were torn between, respecting and honouring their ruler, and going their own way. But most of them would respect Peter even to the extent of humiliating themselves. But a lot of them, of course, weren't conservative either. They were willing to go with Peter on his, on his reform path. I think it's important to remember that a lot, not all Boyer families were conservative. So, amongst his inner circle, a lot were from old traditional Boyer families.
Talking about the more serious, symbolic level, I mean, if you're analysing the seal of Peter the Great, for instance, and I was thinking about the imagery of, for instance, the United States of America after the Revolution, or the French Republic, that also suddenly contains Masonic symbols. Yes? I'm researching the later 18th century, and one of my working theories is that the reason for that is if you want to have a clear cut with the traditions before, we have to choose something else that not is orthodox religion, for instance, in his case, and that, in the case of France and the United States, of course, is not is royal. In Peter the Great's case, of course, that not, does not apply. But anyhow, that you make a clear cut from the ideological foundation of the states of the period before. And to a certain extent, I think one could claim that this applies to Peter as well, but at a very, very early stage. Would you also interpret it in that way? Or, I mean, my spontaneous question would be, how did the seal of his predecessor look like?
That I'm not sure of, actually.
Yes.
What I do know is something about this seal is its development. So the Pygmalion myth, the central part of the seal here. Now, he was particularly interested in this myth from at least 1705, because he commissioned a symbol and emblem book to be printed in Amsterdam for use in Russia. So, for example, ships were named, there was an emblem for every ship, and it was used in each regiment had its symbol and emblem. Going back to the Renaissance tradition, emblematic tradition, and one of the emblems in this book was of Pygmalion and Galatea. So, so he's certainly aware of central myth from Ovid, and he had Ovid in his library. He was a keen reader of Ovid from the early 18th century. But it's just it's not just that. I think it's the combination of different things that add up. For example, as I said, you can see the Tetragrammaton in earlier in Russia, the Hebrew name of God. But it's just a combination of different images together.
Yes.
That is something new.
But the light is sort of dispersing the dark. I mean, there are clouds and so on. This typical kind of Masonic imagery you will find later during the century. But I mean, in the state when, for instance, the United States of America or the French Republic were looking for new symbols, where would they go? And at that stage, of course, Freemasonry had developed into the main form of sociability, And my claim is they are going to a world of imagery that is known to everybody, but this has no references to either, in the case of the United States and the French Republic, the crown or the church, And then you go to Masonry. But I mean, if you would, as I said, this is most certainly not the case with Peter the Great, but I mean, in one sense, he wanted to create something new that radically differed from the old Orthodox traditions.
I mean, certainly, that's not an Orthodox seal at all. No.
That's what I mean, yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
in creating something new, you mentioned about his links with Christopher Wren, or possibly in some way with Christopher Wren in his Grand Embassy. Five years later you get then the creation of St. Petersburg. But these are, if you like, these stories about what happened in Deptford are, one would presume, that with the English tradition. Is there any evidence that it would lead to tension later on? Because the later ones obviously are with the Jacobite traditions of Masonry. And I'm not sure they would lie easily together.
Well, that's a legend myth. I don't know if there's any, you know, I'm not, if Christopher Wren in 1698, there's any proof of that. As a skin, I say that it's a legend that he was initiated by Christopher Wren. So I don't know, you know, there's no proof that he actually met Christopher Wren. It's possible, of course, because he was in London for 3 months. And of course, London at that time was being rebuilt itself. St. Paul's was still being built after the Great Fire. It wasn't completed, I don't think, until the second decade of the 18th century. So London itself would have been, to a certain extent, a building site. So he would have seen, I would imagine, masons at work there. So who knows how that influenced him. But certainly he had Jacobites, you know, at his side from Patrick Gordon in the 1680s, 1690s. So in terms of English or influence, it's more difficult to say.
Well, I could give a reply from the side of the research into Freemasonry in general, and that's basically, we don't know so much about that period, unfortunately. We think that we know enough to say that there were operative Masonic lodges in England at the time, and it's not at all unlikely that Peter the Great, as many other gentlemen of the period, were initiated into kind of operative stonemasons' lodges. Much material was lost and also deliberately burnt in the 1720s, for instance. And so we don't know, and it's of course always a problem to say, well, we are waiting upon that piece of evidence that would prove it, but it is not an unlikely myth, so to speak. It is very likely, indeed. And of course, as historians of the topic, we always hope that we will find the minutes where it is written in clear text that Peter the Great was initiated. He might have been initiated incognito, and then he would find a name, and you would not know if it was him or not. Or it would just read a Russian nobleman or whatever, yes, which would be remarkably enough, of course. But why not? I mean, he took interest in Holland. He was interested in carpentry for ship construction, and I think he also did a proper training as an apprentice. And
well, I mean, during his stay in Holland,
yes,
in London, interested in all sorts of different religions, and in that sense, it would make sense. He went to Quaker meeting houses, he went to synagogues in Holland. He was trying to soak up everything that was going on in Holland and London at the time. So why not soak up? And of course, he was interested in architecture and shipbuilding,
yes,
which is a form of architecture still then, of course, and in architecture in general. So it would make sense that he would go then to the leading architect at the time. But it's just that there's no proof.
Yes.
There's proof that he met Flamsteed, and there's proof that he went to the Mint, where Isaac Newton was the head at the time.
Yeah.
So that's proof. There's no proof of that ring.
Okay. Are there any more questions or comments? If not, I also want to thank you again, Robert, for an excellent lecture and also very nice time for discussion, which does not have to end here because we invite you to some refreshments with wine and some food from PD Taste across the street. So you are most welcome to stay. All right. Thank you again, Robert.